Tonight we're talking about parables, however, not New Testament parables. How many parables from the New Testament can you name? Any favorites? Parable of the sower, parable of the wedding feast. I mean, there's all kinds of them. Parable of the treasure hidden in a field. How many Old Testament parables can you name? That's a little more of a challenge, isn't it? Not quite so many, and they're not quite so obvious. So let's take a look at a few of them, and we'll talk about why in the world we're talking about parables. Let's not do that one. That's too brief. Let's do Judges. Chapter 8. Start here. Judges chapter 8. You remember Gideon, also called Jerubbaal. Let Baal contend for him or with him. That was his second name based on his behavior. So first it was Gideon. He's the guy that put the fleece out and put it out two nights in a row. Once to have the fleece dry when the ground was wet and once to have the fleece wet when the ground was dry. Forget which one was which, but you remember the guy. And then he went and defeated the Midianites with how many guys? 300 guys is all he had. And what were their weapons? Torches covered by pitchers and trumpets. And they would surround the enemy is what their plan was in three different groups. And in the dark of the night, they would blow those trumpets and break the pitchers and the light shone forth and the Midianites woke up and said, they're all around us. And they killed one another in the confusion. That was God's plan to deliver them from the Midian. So Gideon's delivered the Midianites. But Gideon had a lot of wives. We read this in verse 28 of chapter 8. So Midian was subdued before the sons of Israel, and they did not lift up their heads anymore. And the land was undisturbed for 40 years in the days of Gideon. Then Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, same guy, Gideon, Jerubbaal, same guy. He went and lived in his own house. Gideon had 70 sons who were his direct descendants, for he had many wives. Can you imagine the 1040 that he would need to put 70 sons? His concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son, and he named him Abimelech. Gideon, the son of Joash, died in a ripe old age and was buried in the tomb of his father Joash in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. It came about as soon as Gideon was dead that the sons of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal-berith their god. Pretty typical that you see in Judges of this kind of thing happening. Well, it says in chapter 9, verse 1, Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, Gideon's son by his concubine, living in Shechem, went to his mother's relatives, spoke to them and to the whole clan of the household of his mother's father, saying, speak now in the hearing of all the leaders of Shechem, which is better for you, that 70 men, all the sons of Jerubbaal, rule over you, or that one man rule over you? Also remember that I am your bone and your flesh. And his mother's relatives spoke all these words on his behalf in the hearing of all the leaders of Shechem. And they were inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he is our relative. They gave him 70 pieces of silver from the house of Baal-berith, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless fellows, and they followed him. Then he went to his father's house at Ophrah and killed his brothers, the sons of Jerubbaal, 70 men, on the stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, was left, for he hid himself. All the men of Shechem and Beth Millo assembled together, and they went and made Abimelech king by the oak of the pillar, which was in Shechem. What a travesty, what a shameful thing that Gideon's son would murder his brothers so that he might be the leader. And this wasn't something he did off in a corner. His whole family conspired with him to do this. And they funded it with money from an idolatrous temple. Quite a situation. No respect for Gideon, no respect for his family, no appreciation for what he had done in previous years. You know, that would never happen today, right? Things haven't changed much. Well, Jotham is the one son that escaped. He's the youngest, and somehow he got away. He escaped. So it says in verse 7, Remember, we're talking about parables tonight. When they told Jotham, he went and stood on the top of Mount Gerizim and lifted his voice. By the way, any significance to Mount Gerizim? Remember, Moses was told by God, when the people of Israel get into the land of Canaan, you put half of them on Mount Ebal and half of them on Mount Gerizim. And you're going to repeat the blessings from Mount Ebal of keeping the law. And from Mount Gerizim, you're going to repeat the curses if you fail to keep the law. So Mount Gerizim was where half of Israel gathered to pronounce the curses that would come upon the people if they failed to keep the law of God. And this is where he is now. Jotham lifted up his voice and he called out. Thus he said to them, "Listen to me, O men of Shechem, that God may listen to you. Once the trees went forth to anoint a king over them, and they said to the olive tree, 'Reign over us.' But the olive tree said to them, 'Shall I leave my fatness with which God and men are honored and go to wave over the trees?' Then the tree said to the fig tree, 'You come, reign over us.' But the fig tree said to them, 'Shall I leave my sweetness and my good fruit and go wave over the trees?' Then the tree said to the vine, 'You come, reign over us.' But the vine said to them, 'Shall I leave my new wine with cheer, which cheers God and men and go to wave over the trees?' Finally, all the trees said to the bramble, 'You come, reign over us.'" What's a bramble? It's a briar. That's a worthless bush. It's not even an actual bush. It has no, well, I hate to say it has no value. You know what they say about a weed? A weed is just a plant whose virtues have not yet been discovered. That's what a weed is. But the bramble, that's quintessentially the curse. Remember when Adam sinned, God cursed the ground that it would bring forth thorns and weeds. Brambles, basically, is what it would bring forth. So now all the trees have gone to the bramble, said, "We don't want to reign. We don't want to give up what we're doing, so why don't you be king?" And the bramble said this. Talking bramble, only in a parable, right? The bramble said to the trees, "If in truth you are anointing me as king over you, come and take refuge in my shade." Now, wait a minute, think about that. How much shade does a briar have? Not much. Not much. And he's telling trees to come take refuge in his shade. "But if not, may fire come out from the bramble and consume the cedars of Lebanon." Why is that significant for the bramble? Because that's what brambles were for. You gathered them up, you cut them, you chopped them up, and you burn them. That's all they were worth. And they weren't even good firewood. "There, therefore, if you have dealt in truth," this is what Jotham is saying after he's told the parable. "If you have dealt in truth and integrity in making Abimelech king, if you've dealt well with Jerubbaal and his house and have dealt well with him as he deserved, for my father fought for you and risked his life and delivered you from the hand of Midian. But if you've risen against my father's house today and have killed his sons, 70 men on one stone, and have made Abimelech, the son of his maidservant, king over the men of Shechem, because he is your relative, if you have dealt in truth and integrity with Jerubbaal and his house this day, rejoice in Abimelech and let him rejoice also with you. But if not, let fire come out from Abimelech and consume the men of Shechem and Beth Millo. And let fire come out from the men of Shechem from Beth Millo and consume Abimelech." And Jotham escaped and fled and went to Beer and remained there because of Abimelech, his brother. Pretty interesting account, wouldn't you say? A lot of bad stuff happened. And bad stuff is still happening. We need not think that this is something unique to ancient history. These kinds of things are still going on in one way or another. But to illustrate the situation, Jotham, instead of just saying, "This is what Abimelech did and this is what you did," he told the story in parable form. And it really helps put it in perspective. And this is what parables do. A parable, maybe you've heard the definition of a parable as an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. And that is true of the parables that Jesus told, because he was trying to teach us the unknown using the known. That's what parables do. You take something that's known and use that to teach something that's unknown. What's the kingdom like? Well, a kingdom's like a man throwing a wedding feast for his son. Oh, we've seen wedding feasts. We know that people do that to celebrate a wedding. That's a good thing to celebrate. That's a happy time, a good time. So the kingdom's like that? Yeah, that's the way it is. That's why Jesus pictured the kingdom. Kingdom's also like a treasure hidden in a field. You're going through that field and you find that treasure and you think, man, I got to buy this field. It illustrates the circumstance. It's usually not a true story, but it's one that could be true and one that people could relate to because they could understand it. And it takes us from what we know, leading us into what we don't know. We didn't know about the kingdom until Jesus revealed these things in parables. They help us to see things from a different perspective. Have you seen all the displays out in the foyer, all those cool displays about our seniors? If you haven't seen those, take advantage of them when you finish the... Wait till the sermon's over. go out there and take a look at those things. And when you read those, the front, you will get a perspective of these young people that you may not have had before. Another thing you can do is you can approach from the office area, because when I came in this morning, I came in from the office area and I saw the back of those displays and I thought, who stacked up all those cardboard boxes out there? Because that's what it looked like from that perspective. And this is what a parable does. It shows you the truth from a perspective you may not have been able to see it from before. And that's what Jotham is doing. He said, you know what you guys did? You chose the bramble to reign over you. You chose the briar, the worst of all plants, the one that brings us all the trouble, the one we try to eliminate. That's the one you made king. And so he showed him what happened. And then he brought a curse with that. Talked about fire coming from the bramble and consuming those who made it the king. And that's exactly what happened in a figure. You read the rest of this history. And the men of Shechem and Abimelech started to have some bad blood between them. Wonder why. And so they went to war with one another. And Abimelech was wiping out the people of Shechem. And then he pursued them to what was the name of that town where there was a tower? And he was attacking that tower in Thebes. And it was a lady on top of that tower who took a piece of a millstone and threw it off. And it hit old Abimelech right square on the head. Didn't kill him, though. But Abimelech told one of his soldiers, take your sword and kill me, because I don't want anybody to be able to say that I was killed by a woman. This guy was messed up in more ways than one. So there you have a parable from the Old Testament that you may not have noticed before. Well, here's another one, maybe more familiar. It's from 2 Samuel chapter 12. I say more familiar because you may be familiar with the account of David and his sin with Bathsheba. His army was away fighting, and a young lady named Bathsheba was bathing on a rooftop, and he saw her and wanted her for himself, and so he sent, brought her to himself. Her husband is out with the army. He's a faithful soldier of David, and he's out fighting with David's army. And David is doing an evil thing with his wife. And so she comes to be with child. And David says, oh man, we got to cover this up. And so he tries to get Uriah, the Hittite, her husband, his faithful soldier, to come back into town and spend the night with his wife so that he will later on think that this child is his. Now, I don't want to be critical of David, but just how deceitful is that? You just can't pass up on the fact that that's pretty dark, David. It really is. And God will say later through his prophet Nathan that in doing these things, David despised him. Now, what's David called in other places? He's called a man after God's own heart. That's why every time I talk about David, I talk about the fact that this guy gives me a lot of hope. Because you can do some really bad things, And God will still love you as long as you do one thing, and that one thing is repent. Well, David finally had Uriah killed because he couldn't convince him that this was his child, couldn't cover up his sin. So it did what sin does. Unless you face up to it, it continues to escalate and gets worse and worse and worse, and that's exactly what happened. So he finally had Uriah killed. Well, God sends his prophet. The prophet's name is Nathan, and we read about Nathan in chapter 12 of 2 Samuel, verse 1. The Lord said to Nathan, or the Lord sent Nathan to David and came to him and said, there were two men in one city, the one rich and the other poor. He's telling a parable, but David doesn't know it's a parable. He thinks Nathan is telling him about this situation that's arisen in another town. It says, the rich man had a great many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he brought and nourished, or which he bought and nourished. And it grew up together with him and his children. It would eat of his bread and drink of his cup and lie in his bosom, and was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take from his own flock or his own herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. Rather, he took the poor man's ewe lamb and prepared it for the man who had come into him. Now you get the story. There's two men. One's rich and one's poor. The poor guy has one treasure, though, and it's that little lamb. Nourishes it, loves that lamb. But this rich guy's got all kinds of things, and the rich guy has a traveler friend come to him to stay, and instead of taking of his own flocks and his own resources and feeding this wayfarer, he goes and he takes that poor man's one lamb, his one treasure, and that's what he feeds to this traveler. Verse 5. David's anger burned greatly against the man. And he said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, surely the man who has done this deserves to die. I mean, you can't disagree. But see, this is what we're talking about regarding the perspectives that a parable will give you. David did not see himself in the parable. And it was that way when Jesus told parables. People did not see themselves at first. They were just listening to the parables. Like, oh, this is a really pleasant story. And then you get to the end of it and you find, oh, it's all about me and how bad I am. In some cases, it was just exactly like that. And then they became angry because they saw that they were convicted by the truths that Jesus taught. But Nathan tells David, verse 7, famous line. What is it? You're the man. You know it. You're the man. That sticks out with us, doesn't it? How many times could that be said of you or me regarding some sin? Marty, you're the man. God, I know. And what did David do? He didn't deny it. He's done covering things up. At this point, the parable has had its impact, and it's helped David to see the truth, and he sees himself for who and what he really is, and he repents. It's not the end of the story. There will be repercussions, consequences for all that David has done. But the value in looking at the parable is to see this is how David got his eyes opened. How else would he have gotten his... If Nathan had just come in and said, David, this is what you did and this is evil, I don't know if he would have had the same conviction about his sin that he did when he kind of discovered himself in the parable. You see how that worked? David was so obviously ready to condemn the man because he clearly saw the evil in what this fictitious man did in stealing that guy's one lamb. But he never put himself in that spot, apparently, until Nathan told him the parable and he said, that's me. That's me. How valuable was this particular parable? Just a story, right? Just a story. That's all the parables of Jesus were, just stories, right? They revealed some things way beyond what we could have known otherwise. Isaiah chapter 5. Just going to look at three. This is the third and last one we'll look at tonight. This morning in class, you may have heard me reference Isaiah chapter 5 a little farther on down. Verse 20, where Isaiah says, woe to those who put good for evil and evil for good, who put sweet for bitter and bitter for sweet. Well, this is that same chapter, but we're starting in the beginning of it. Isaiah chapter 5, verse 1. Let me sing now for my well-beloved, a song of my well-beloved concerning his vineyard. Vineyards seem to be pretty good topics for parables. My well-beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill. He dug it all around, removed the stones, planted it with the choicest vine, and he built a tower in the middle of it, and he also hewed out a wine vat in it, and then he expected it to produce good grapes. But it produced only worthless ones. Well, without even finishing the parable, what are you going to do with such a vineyard? It only produces lousy grapes. I know, I said lousy. You're not supposed to say that, are you? Do you remember that episode of I Love Lucy, where they were going to get somebody to help them be a little more classy, and they were talking to a speech therapist, and he said, okay, there's two words I want you to never use. One of them's lousy, and the other one is, what was the other word? What was the other one? Now I can't think of the other word. Swell. One of them's lousy, and the other one's swell. He said, okay, what are they? And that's so funny to me, because they thought he was telling them not to use a lousy word, and the word was lousy. Anyway, talk to you later about that. See me in the foyer. But it's a lousy vineyard. It produces lousy grapes. Verse 3, and now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. He's asking, all right, I just told you about this vineyard. What are you going to do with it? What more was there to do for my vineyard than I have not done in it? Why then I expected it to produce good grapes? Did it produce worthless ones? So now let me tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge and it will be consumed. What's he mean, I'll remove its hedge and it'll be consumed? Well, when he made the vineyard, he put the hedge around it. That's a wall that protects it. Protects it from animals coming in and eating the vines. Protects it from people who would come in to steal. That's what the tower was for as well. Put the tower in there so you can put a watchman up in the tower to make sure people don't come in and steal all the vineyard or whatever. They just keep watch over it. That's what all this is for. So he says, I'm going to remove the hedge and it'll be consumed. I'll break down its wall and it'll become trampled ground. I will lay it waste. It will not be pruned or hoed, but briars and thorns will come up. I will also charge the clouds to rain no rain on it. And then he lowers the boom in verse 7. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his delightful plant. Thus he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. For righteousness, but behold, a cry of distress. The picture of the vineyard's obvious. You plant a vineyard, you expect to get something good for it. That's a lot of work to plant a vineyard. A lot of work to build that hedge. It's a lot of work to build that tower. It's a lot of work, a lot of investment, time and money, labor. You put all that into the vineyard and you're doing all that to get grapes. And what do you get? You don't get any good grapes. What did God do for Israel? That's the question God is asking through Isaiah. I set you guys up great. I protected you. I watched over you. I provided for you. I raised you up and made you a nation from among, not from among the nations, but in the midst of all the nations. I created you as a nation through Abraham. We talked about that somewhat this morning. And look what you've done. You've rebelled against me. You've embraced foreign gods. All the things that Isaiah would later talk about is what they had done. And it's all encapsulated in this one simple story about a no good vineyard. Put all that work into it and you get nothing. You've seen that kind of thing. You've heard about that kind of thing. You read about it. Maybe it's happened to you. You really work hard on something and it turns out to be a big flop. It had so much promise at one time, but man, it's lousy. You wanted it to be swell, but it's lousy. That's what God wound up with in Israel after all this investment. That's why when you go to read the prophet Hosea, you're going to see a very interesting tale there. It's kind of a parable acted out through Isaiah and his wife. What was his wife's name? Anybody remember? I'll give you a clue. Golly. Her name was Gomer. Yeah, her name was Gomer. Now, if you don't watch Gomer Pyle, you probably wouldn't relate to that. But what was Gomer? She was a harlot. God said to Hosea, his prophet, you go and marry this woman of harlotry. Marry her, because when she cheats on you, all the time she cheats on you, my people are going to see that, my prophet being cheated on, and they're going to know what it's like for me to be God over you. sort of another parable-like situation. But you might not see it unless you had that illustration. And that's what parables do. They illustrate things. So here's the end of the lesson. The next time you think of a parable, the next time you read of a parable, understand why that exists. It's God trying to help you and me to put an easy framework on truth. That's what parables are all about. It's a way to communicate something. When I was much younger, I'd pick up a book, and before I decided to read it, I'd flip through it. What am I looking for? Pictures. Somebody knows I'm looking for pictures. Why that? Because in my youth, pictures are one of the things I depended on to get information. I want to know more. I want to see more. And later on, you realize, you know, words paint pretty good pictures. And that's what parables are. They're pictures made out of words. And God is trying to teach us with these things. Well, that's the end of the lesson. I hope that you see the value in these parables, maybe familiar now with you that weren't before. But at any rate, the one thing we know about parables is God's trying to lead us to Him. So tonight, if you're ready to give yourself to the Lord, or if you're needing prayers of this congregation, need to learn more about whatever, we want to talk to you about that before you leave here tonight. So let's stand and sing the invitation song together for anybody who might want to respond.